This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Gibbons are considered an endangered species and are threatened primarily by loss of their forest habitat, but also other factors like the illegal wildlife trade, the use of their body parts in medicines, and poaching as well. Mariani Rumley and Dr. Susan Lappin are two people working in the area of gibbon conservation. Mariani is the advisor of the Gibbon Protection Society of Malaysia, and she's also the project manager of the Gibbon Rehabilitation Project. And Dr. Susan Lappin is a visiting Fulbright researcher at the School of Biological Sciences in USM Malaysia, and she's also the assistant professor of biological anthropology at the Appalachian State University in the USA. And they join me now to highlight the importance of conservation efforts for gibbons. Welcome, ladies. How are you today?
Great. Good. Hi.
Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So yes, you know, gibbons don't, you know, people don't really talk about them as much as, let's say, you know, the pandas, for example. So we'll get into that. But Ben, maybe you can tell me, how did you first get involved in rehabilitating rescued wildlife?
I started involved in rehabilitating rescued wildlife when I was in the Department of Wildlife and National Parks, Perhelitan. On 2012, I've been seconded with Copenhagen Zoo, act as a delegate between Perhelitan and the Copenhagen Zoo.
Sure.
And I do camera trapping for wildcat survey.
Okay.
Okay, then I always went into the jungle. And when I go to the jungle, I brought the wildlife and trained them there.
Okay.
I introduced them the jungle again because these expats wildlife been hand-raised by human. They never know where they are from. Can you imagine? It must be weird or awkward for them to feel living with human that they thought are their parents, that have no thick coat like them, eating food that made them sick, the noise in the city. So that's why I introduced them to their real home.
Okay, so these are rescued gibbons, animals that you have found.
Yeah, rescued.
Confiscated, okay, because you used to also work with Perhelitan?
Yes.
Okay, all right. And yes. Susan, you you are a biological anthropologist, you're a behavioral ecologist. What are some of your research interests?
Well, I originally started off working with gibbons because of my interest in their social behavior and their sort of their family life, if you will. Gibbons have really unusual mating systems and unusual patterns of parenting behavior. But I stayed with them out of just love. They are fascinating animals, and I can't imagine, you know, ever running out of questions to ask about them. So some of the work that I've done with them includes trying to better understand how their ecological environment shapes their social behavior, how environmental change affects them, and how they adapt, how they are adapting or failing to adapt to the kinds of changes that humans have imposed on the world around them.
So we're talking things like habitat loss and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I've looked at some of my more recent research has looked at things like how forest fires affect the animals that survive in the forest, and looking at questions about how their territoriality limits their behavioral options when they experience habitat damage.
Okay. I think people don't actually know so much about gibbons. You know, they're not, like we mentioned earlier, you know, they're not really talked about. Tell me a little bit about the gibbons farm, maybe specifically in Malaysia.
Okay. Well, in Malaysia, there are five species of gibbons, three of which are found in peninsular Malaysia, two in Malaysian Borneo. There is some question about that. Bam and I were actually talking earlier about the fact that there's some uncertainty about distribution ranges of some of the gibbons in Malaysia. So it's possible that there could be as many as seven.
Okay.
That remains to be seen.
Okay.
But here in the peninsula, there are three. There's the white-handed gibbon, Hylobates lar. There's the agile gibbon, Hylobates agilis. I'm giving you the Latin names because I'm a scientist. I can't help myself. And the Siamang, Symphalangus syndactylus. And there are certain things that they all have in common. They all spend almost all of their time up in the trees. One of the reasons maybe that they don't get as much attention as some wildlife like elephants that people see a lot is that they live only in intact forests and they spend all their time up there rather than down here on the ground with us.
Sure.
And that's not something that's optional for them. Their entire body is designed around being incredible acrobats in the trees and kind of clumsy and awkward on the ground. So that's very much sort of a part of their entire lifestyle. They move really fast and gracefully in the trees. Their diets consist largely of ripe fruit. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons that selective logging can be problematic for them if it removes the older canopy fruit trees that they really depend on, or the lianas that grow on those older canopy fruit trees. They also, one of their most spectacular behaviors, and the thing that really made me fall in love with them, is that like birds, they sing.
Yes, so, yes, you know, I was reading about that.
Yeah. When you go into a forest that has gibbons, you know that they're there, because at least if you go in the early morning, because if you go in really early, it's quiet, and then suddenly a song starts, and then another one, and then in a healthy forest, another one, and another one, and then soon you're surrounded by this amazing chorus of gibbon songs. Each pair is singing a duet. So there's a male and a part and a female
amazing
part, and they sing them together in a coordinated manner that says, you know, we think, says, we are paired, we're a couple, and this is our territory, so leave us alone and we'll leave you alone, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, they are also endangered. Mm-hmm. And why, I mean, I mentioned very briefly why. Maybe you could elaborate on, you know, either of you could elaborate on why, what are the threats they are facing?
The threats for gibbons in the wild is, one, if this deforestation, and then second, and the most concerning now is illegal pet trade. So they shoot, normally the poachers or the hunters, they will aim for the baby gibbons. But to take the baby gibbons, they need to kill the parents.
Right.
Because gibbons is the only monogamous primate. Like human, they consist father, mother, and couple of siblings. That's all. They are not like macaque. Macaque live in a big family, like 20 or 30 of them.
Sure.
But gibbons, they stay in a family together in the jungle. Like only 5 or maximum 6 of them. So they protect each other. Mm-hmm. So when their young baby been threatened, all of them will protect them. And of course, for the poachers to get the baby, the others will be killed. That's why they are like easily to extinct, I can say, because even the from one bird to another bird, it takes like 3 to 4 years.
Right, right. Okay, they don't reproduce every year as such.
Right.
Okay.
And they also take a very long time to grow up.
Yeah.
So, for example, sea mungs are the species I've studied the longest, so I tend to focus on them in conversations. But it takes a female about 10 years to reach reproductive maturity, which is astonishingly long for such a small animal. You know, if you a sea mung is only about 11 kilos, so the size of kind of a medium-sized dog that's going to grow up in, what, a year and a half and be able to have a litter every, you know, every few months really.
Yeah.
So you know, for a gibbon, if it takes them 8 to 10 years to grow up, and then a female can have one baby every 2.5, 3, 4 years. Not all of those babies survive. What this means is, first of all, the females are incredibly important. If you kill one female, it takes 10 years to grow another one.
Yes.
Yeah. And each infant lost represents at least one female lost, because they always kill the mother. That's how they get the baby. They shoot her, she falls. Sometimes they kill the baby too, so then they have to kill another mother. And when transporting those infants, the infants are stressed, sometimes injured. So most of the infants that they capture don't make it to the market. So one infant being sold as a pet represents several other dead infants and that many dead mothers as well. And so this is the kind of losses that, because of their very slow reproduction, they can't sustain. What this also means is that it's difficult to get a sense of how they're doing in the wild, because their reproduction happens at such a slow rate that the fact that there are adults out there doesn't mean that they're replacing themselves. They have very long lifespans. So this is one of the things that as an ecologist I worry about, that when we see that there are gibbons in a forest, we tend to think, okay, that's good, they're still there. But that doesn't mean that they're reproducing at replacement rates. So the fact that we can go out and hear gibbons still singing in the forest, especially in degraded forests, doesn't necessarily mean that those represent healthy populations.
Okay, all right. And I guess the, you know, going to the wildlife pet trade, I suppose the difficulty in actually getting these poor baby gibbons even makes them even more, I suppose, a more lucrative business then, doesn't it? Because low supply and high demand, is that what happens as well?
Yeah.
Okay, that is really quite tragic. What do you think is fueling this, the wildlife pet trade, specifically for gibbons? What do you think is fueling that?
The thing that fueling this trade is actually the demand from public, mm-hmm. especially Malaysian celebrity here.
Malaysian celebrities?
Yes, or public figure that post their wildlife pet, their gibbon pets on their social media. Imagine how many followers they have, let's like millions or 100,000s. And then let's say 50% of them want to do the same. These celebrities, these people will create a trend. It's becoming a trend now here in Malaysia. Okay. And pet trade is booming Southeast Asia, especially Malaysia also.
Yeah.
So it's already a trend having a primate pet at home. And people love to follow trend. Mm-hmm. They wanted to look cool for having rare pet, exotic. They put dress on them, make them look like human. Maybe put lipsticks, smoke cigarette or vape to make them entertaining, funny. And they will post on their social media, tag their family, friends. They wanted to show people that they are animal lover, so-called animal lover. Mm-hmm. So these things that fueling this trend.
Okay, and you've actually seen this for yourself,
yes.
haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. How exactly is social media, fueling all of this, this wildlife pet trade? What role does social media actually play in all of this?
Buying exotic animals via social media platforms remain fairly easy based on an investigation conducted last year by the Star newspaper. In fact, according to a survey by the International Anti-Trafficking Watchdog Traffic on 2016, the online sale of protected animals has reached alarming levels in Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
After a 5-month investigation, Traffic's researchers discovered that more than a dozen Facebook groups in Peninsular Malaysia alone were dedicated to buying and selling hundreds of protected species from Malayan sun bear to gibbons. Online traders are selling protected animals as exotic pets, fueled by the popularity of this animal as the next in trend things to have, like mm-hmm. I said before.
Yeah.
These animals are displaced from their natural habitat and families and are doomed to suffer and die in a prolonged death at the hands of the owners, who generally lack knowledge on how to care for these animals. This tendency came about in 2013, simultaneously with the widespread use of social media in Malaysia. Until May 2018, based on our own monitoring, GPSM monitoring, there are 63 accounts using various mediums of social media selling wildlife. They're now even looking for agents and dropships to sell their stock.
Oh my goodness.
And based on the general survey information from online monitoring reports and data exchange with Indonesian online wildlife traders monitor, started January to May this year alone, there are 16 active accounts selling wildlife in Indonesia. This is comparison between Malaysia and Indonesia. Their medium are Facebook and Instagram, only these two things. While in Malaysia, we are more creative. We use Facebook, Instagram, WeChat, WhatsApp, Muda.my and other websites.
Muda.my?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
But these numbers, some factors might affect the numbers, such as the local knowledge or access to the internet and technology. But this is still a concern for Malaysia, as this show that Malaysians are already good at misusing the internet and social media.
Okay, and I suppose if anyone who's, against this, if they see these sorts of sites, they can also help to report it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, to Facebook, to whoever. I mean, these are, after all, well, illegal.
Yep.
Okay, so, I'm sure that's something that you would encourage as well.
Yeah, they can do two things. One is, three things maybe. They can first screenshot and send to us and send to the wildlife department. The second thing is they can report to Facebook or Instagram. And third thing, they can educate the people that's selling the things. Just comment there. Don't buy. It's cruelty. Yeah.
Okay, so speak out essentially, right?
Yes.
And take some action. Don't just, I suppose, don't just look at it and just say, oh, terrible, and not do anything about it. So take some action, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We need to voicing their silence.
Okay. Do people even realize that this is illegal? Do they even realize that, gibbons are an endangered species? I mean, they are listed under the IUCN as endangered, right?
Yes, and it's illegal to kill them or keep them as pets in Malaysia as well. So both under international agreements, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, all of the legal frameworks are unanimous in forbidding this practice. And yet, as Bam pointed out, you see photographs on social media. People clearly have no awareness that they're breaking the law and advertising the fact that they're breaking the law for anyone to see.
Mm-hmm. I guess because they're very cute animals, aren't they, unfortunately?
Yeah, actually, I do monitoring. I do any monitoring for them. I saw their conversation in one of the WhatsApp group. Someone offer Hari Raya promotion for a baby gibbons. Like, okay, before this, the price is 5,000. Now I offer you 3,000 because it's almost Hari Raya. Why don't you show your friends you have a baby gibbons, a baby? So there's people ask in the group for confirmation whether they need license to keep it as pet. And then the seller said, you can't have license or permit for gibbons because it's illegal. And he even said, no need to worry. If you love them, then just keep them. Law are meant to be broken.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Mariani Ramli. She's an advisor for the Gibbon Protection Society of Malaysia, and she's also the project manager of the Gibbon Rehabilitation Project. And Dr. Susan Lappin, she's a visiting Fulbright researcher from the School of Biological Sciences in USM, and she's also an assistant professor of biological anthropology from the Appalachian State University in the USA. And we are discussing gibbon conservation. After this quick break, we'll find out more about the efforts to rehabilitate these pets once they've been well rescued from these very terrible people taking them illegally. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today, two very lovely ladies. Mariani Ramli, she's an advisor for the Gibbon Protection Society of Malaysia, and she's also the project manager for the Gibbon Rehabilitation Project. And Dr. Susan Lappin, she's a visiting Fulbright researcher at the School of Biological Sciences in USM, and she's also an assistant professor of biological anthropology at the Appalachian State University in USA. And we're discussing their efforts or their work in gibbon conservation. So just before the break, Bam, we were talking about the illegal wildlife trade and, you know, how people are selling them for very cheap and, well, not cheap, they're very expensive, yeah. But, you know, telling people to flout, you know, laws that have been the international laws that are there to protect these gibbons. Mm-hmm. What happens, I mean, these are wild animals at the end of the day, right? So what actually happens when you start keeping a wild animal in your house? I mean, how does that start to affect the gibbons?
Okay. Just to add a bit about the Act, actually, gibbons are totally protected species under the Wildlife Conservation Act 2010, 716. So if you keep juvenile gibbons, baby gibbons at home, you can be charged until 200,000 ringgit and jail 10 years. Normally, these gibbons, when they're still young, the owner will bring them everywhere, brought them everywhere. But when they started to grow, like two years old or 3 years old, they become so active. Because their wild home range is like 2 to 3 kilometers. Can you imagine your house is how many feet?
Yeah.
And your car and your room? So when they feel like confined, they started to become stressed, demotivated. Some of them start to become crazy. Mm-hmm. They pull their own hair. There's also biting your own hand. Or they do like self-harming, any self-harming that can... They don't have any motivation to live anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And you've seen this for yourself. You have actually rescued gibbons who were kept as pets.
Yes.
Maybe you can share some of your experiences of some of the gibbons that you've rescued.
There's one case of gibbons. His name is Daru. He's been kept in a small cage. Like he's only been fed once or twice a week. When he was young, he was still cute and the owner still liked him. But when he was big, he decided to like put him in a cage and yeah. And then the owner kids, they poke him in the with stick, and that made Daru become crazy.
Of course,
he bit his own arm. He pulled his own hair. Yeah, he became a crazy gibbon. He just want to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
But now after 4 years, it's a bit hard because when I rescued Daru, he don't even want to eat because he don't used to eat. He's been fed one or twice
a week.
Food is not important for him. So I need to treat him psychologically and I want to make him eat. That's the most important thing. I want him to eat first before I can do other treatment. But yeah, for now, it's more than 4 years now. He started to sing. He have like thick coat. He's so active. He like to show off his his body. He's in a good condition now.
Okay. All right. But I mean, when you found him, obviously, like you said, he was trying to kill himself because, you know, they're wild animals. They're not supposed to be kept in cages.
Yes.
If you compare the life that an animal has in captivity with the life in the wild, as Bam said, a young gibbon will be carried by their mother basically all of the time. For the first 6 months or so of life, they'll start to explore a little bit, but they'll still be with mom for the first, say, 2 years, maybe with dad if they're a Siamang. They also have quite good fathers. But
they become much more independent after that, but they're independent within the context of a social group. Mm-hmm. So that being confined is a stressor. Being alone is another stressor. Mm-hmm. Gibbons in the wild are never alone. They're with a family all the time. Mm-hmm. From the moment they're born, they're with their parents. Groups are very cohesive. They travel together through the forest. They make little soft vocalizations to each other in addition to the big songs that they sing. So even when they can't see each other, they know there's someone there. Mm-hmm. Now imagine being locked in a cage and left alone all day. Being tied in the yard and left alone all day. They are not cut out for this. This is not the kind of life they were meant to have. They're meant to be playing, climbing, exploring. Yeah. Wild gibbons don't just play with their family members. They play with other species too. They play with monkeys. They play with – I've seen them batting at flying squirrels just to make them fly through the forest. So they're these incredibly curious and playful social animals, and to lock them alone in a cage has about the same effect that locking a human being alone in a cage has. It makes them crazy.
And gibbons is the king of breakation. They are the king of swinger. They're the fastest primates in the world. So you put them in a cage, they cannot sing anymore. And they cannot swing anymore.
Yeah.
So, it will be such a...
It's torture, essentially.
Yeah, it's a torture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the ones that were fortunate enough to be found, the ones that you have rehabilitated, is there... I mean... How likely are they to go back into the wild? Is there a possibility of that?
Yeah, it depends on the history of each gibbon.
Sure.
And if the more traumatic they are, it will take longer time. Mm-hmm. But for now, the gibbons is under my care. All of them have potential to be released, but they need to to release the gibbons into the wild again, they need to fulfill 8 criteria. Mm-hmm. They need to know how to sing. They need how to brachiate. They don't have any injuries, handicap. Things
sure,
like that.
Sure. Because, they've been through so much, right? You don't actually know what the history is sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It takes 5 to 10 years to rehabilitate one individual. Yeah.
That's a long time. What is their lifespan again, sorry?
That's a really good question. They live so long that we're not sure how long they live in the wild. Okay. There are wild individuals that are known to be 30 or more years old, or at least estimated to be that based on how long we've been, not me myself, but scientists have been following them. In captivity, they can live 40 years. So these are very long-lived animals. This long, slow lifespan also relates to the problem of rehabilitation, because in the wild, they have a period of 8 to 10 years where they're essentially learning skills from their families.
Yes.
So you can't just – I think people often have this idea, when I'm done with this pet, I'll just let them go.
Yeah.
They won't go. They don't know how to go. Yeah, they don't know how to avoid predators. They don't know how to find food. They don't know how to find a social group. They don't know how to move. They've been on the ground their whole life. They don't know how to move around in the trees. So as Bam was saying, you have to essentially teach them all the things that their family would normally have taught them in the wild before there's any possibility of releasing them.
So I know, Bam, you have your own center actually at the moment, your own space where you are rehabilitating these gibbons that you found. Tell me what the process of that is like actually.
Okay. Wildlife rehabilitation is involving the treatment and care of sick, injured or often wild animals with the goal of releasing healed animals back to their natural habitats in the wild. Mm-hmm. To be released, animals must be able to function in their natural habitat as normal members of their species. In easy words, after confiscation, I will quarantine them for at least a month for health check to ensure they are free from any diseases. After that, they will be introduced with other gibbons to make them socialize so they can learn from each other. How to communicate, how to sing, they play together, they groom each other. They will be put in a big enclosure where there will be enrichment tools there, food puzzle to stimulate their brain, a novel object for them to lift, bamboo for swinging and learn how to balance body. This is to make them active physically and mentally. Their brain will stimulate, they will gain muscle. Once they are mature, they will be paired, and after a few behavioral tests, they are ready physically and mentally, and we can know that they can survive, they can forage for their own food, then they can be released again into the wild. So, like I said, each individual will take around 5 to 7 years to be rehabilitated, depends on how fast they learn.
Okay. And how long have you been doing this for?
almost six years.
And I know that, I mean, now you're working in a secret location. Mm-hmm. Why is that? I mean, what's happened?
Yeah, I receive threats from the illegal traders, mm-hmm. because I'm, what do you call, I disturbing their business.
Right.
Because I also do like public education and awareness. So sure. I ask people, because I don't have power to arrest them, mm-hmm. but I have power to talk to public to stop demanding for this. Do not keep wildlife as pet, because they are not meant to be pet.
To do awareness programs. Yeah.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So they're angry with me because I disturb their business. So they even like spread my pictures to their WhatsApp group to find, like, oh, asking people to find me.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Okay, and so now you've got your own space. And I mean, tell me about the running of that. You know, are you doing it alone? Do you have any help of any sort?
Yeah, I have, for now, like, there are three of us working there.
Okay.
And sometimes I also accept student volunteers to share the knowledge with them. So, yeah, I create a system there. I create a procedures and protocol. So if maybe one day I'm not here anymore, mm-hmm. people can still continue this project.
Yeah,
people need to continue this. Because other countries in Southeast Asia, they already started Gibbon Project since 1990s. Mm-hmm. And Malaysia haven't established the real one yet. So this thing need to be continued.
So tell me a bit about then the Gibbon Protection Society of Malaysia. I mean, you're part of that. You know, is that a newly formed sort of organization? What do you guys actually do?
Yeah. This society been established on 2016.
Mm-hmm. And it's very recent, huh?
Yeah. So I already do the rehabilitation for a long time, but then I realized rehabilitation itself is not enough. I need to stop people from taking the gibbons out from the jungle. So that's why I founded this society, and we start approaching public with this thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I mean, how are people responding to that? You know, are you seeing more awareness perhaps, you know?
Yeah, I can see more awareness, and there's people contacting me, giving information about pet trade.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and people contacting me asking about other primates too. They know, can we feed wild monkey? Things like that. It's encouraging.
Okay, all right. And Susan, from the scientist point of view, mm-hmm. I mean, you're here doing a lot of research mm-hmm. in the area. I mean, tell me a bit about what you're working on specifically here.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Malaysia was it's something that always surprises people when I tell them this, but Malaysia was one of the first places in the world that long-term fieldwork was done on wild primates. Everybody knows about Jane Goodall. Mm-hmm. But just a couple years later, David Chivers came from the UK to Malaysia and instituted some really groundbreaking work on siamangs, agile gibbons, he and his students, agile gibbons and lar gibbons here in Malaysia. And up until the early 80s, there was a reasonable research presence here. And then something happened, and I don't quite know what that was, but when you look through the literature on gibbons in Malaysia, in the early 80s, it just disappears. Suddenly, we have no information about the status, you know, updated status of gibbons in Malaysia. And as everybody knows, concurrently with the sort of loss of information or loss of tracking of the status of gibbons in Malaysia, there's been enormous economic development in Malaysia, mm-hmm. which is coupled with changes in land use patterns such that throughout the distribution range of these three species, the IUCN estimates that at least 70% of the habitat for each of the three species found here in Malaysia has been lost. These estimates are based almost entirely on data that have come from outside of Malaysia. So mm-hmm. I have worked for a couple of decades in Indonesia and was working on a project one day, and I kind of had this sudden realization that we have no idea what's happening with gibbons in Malaysia, that the status, how many there are, where they still live. Of course, we know that they are still present in many forests around Malaysia, but the actual population status, all we can do is speculate. So with a whole team of wonderful researchers from University Science Malaysia, including three fantastic Malaysian graduate students and an international team of faculty, we've initiated a series of surveys across different sites in peninsular Malaysia to try to get a handle on really what is happening with each of these three species. So recently we've just wrapped up surveys in the area around Merapo near Taman Negara. We're analyzing the data now, so I can't tell you exactly what we found, but results there were somewhat encouraging, I'll say that. We have a student in the field today conducting surveys in Ulu Muda. Soon we're going to initiate surveys in Taman Negara. So we're trying to get some numbers so that we can do a couple of things. First, we can develop an updated sense of what the actual status of each species in Malaysia is. Mm-hmm. Second, we can identify what kinds of habitats they're doing best in and what kinds of habitats they're really struggling in. Our goal is to develop a sort of scientific basis for allowing the wildlife authorities to design conservation management plans that will allow these gibbons to persist. And if you don't mind me sort of putting in a sales pitch for why gibbons are important, we've, I think, already talked a bit about why gibbons are interesting. But what people often don't realize is that not only do forests perform essential functions for people, things like managing flood prevention, storing water, capturing carbon, but also that it's not just the trees that perform these important functions. Animals perform important functions too. And recent research coming out of several different teams working in several different countries show that gibbons are a crucial element of forest ecosystems. They plant the trees, essentially, by eating seeds of fruits, moving to a new place, and then planting those seeds. They are excellent dispersers and irreplaceable dispersers of some of the most important trees in the forest for lots of wildlife. So if we lose our gibbons, we're going to lose not just the gibbons, but those tree species that depend on the gibbons and then the other animal species that depend on those tree species. So their ecological function is another component of conservation planning that mm-hmm. is incredibly important. So another thing that my team here is doing is trying to help people to understand that not only do the gibbons need us to care for them, but we need them too.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very easy for us to kind of separate, you know, what's happening in the jungle to what's happening to us. You know, it's that common thing of, you know, so what if you cut down a few mm-hmm. acres of forest? It's not going to affect me, but actually it mm-hmm. does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
To add a bit, actually, what's a bit sad here, actually gibbons do the same function like orangutan. Right. But we know about orangutan. There's already efforts to save orangutans. And gibbons is human family, in the same family like us, like humans, chimpanzee, gorilla, orangutan, and then gibbons. Actually, they are like person in the jungle. And that's why we need, in Malaysia, the only one university now start. So maybe we can encourage more academicians to study more about gibbons here in Malaysia.
What we're finding is that there's actually a lot of interest. We've been contacted by, Bam was actually telling me earlier today about another student at a different university that's interested in working with gibbons. So the problem isn't that there's a lack of interest. The problem is that we just haven't built the network yet. So mm-hmm. one of the reasons we're excited to talk to you today is to get the word out that that there's this work that needs to be done. It's fun. It's interesting. Okay, talking about all of the sadness, there's sadness too,
sure,
but they're amazing animals, and spending time in the forest with them or in the rehabilitation center with them is the best. It's really rewarding and fun, and we really hope that over time we can recruit more of these dynamic young people to come and work with us.
Okay. And you know, research aside, I mean, what would you like just regular people to mm-hmm. to also understand and to take away with them?
Gibbons is a part of us. They are, I can consider them as person, and they are so special. We need to remember if you love them, to love is to let go. You cannot keep them at home. Just enjoy them being wild, so they will stay there. Like, because if no gibbons, there are no gibbons in the jungle, there will no more melody in the jungle.
Okay.
I would also add to that something else people need to understand about interacting with wild primates. We've been discussing this whole time the harms that we can do to them. Mm-hmm. There is another element of the pet trade that is frightening, and that is the potential harms that they can do to us. Because gibbons and other primates are very closely related to humans, they have the potential to not only catch our diseases, which is something that does happen, but they also have the potential to bring diseases into the human population. Mm-hmm. Some of the listeners may remember the epidemic of SARS. Yep. A few decades ago. That virus had its origins in a wild bat that was transmitted to humans in wet markets. Anytime that humans are interacting closely with wild animals, and especially with wild mammals, there's the potential for the next SARS to leap over the species boundary. So I don't mean to be alarmist and to say, you know, don't keep primates as pets because we're all going to die. But I kind of do mean to say that this kind of contact is inappropriate. We are similar enough to them that we can pass diseases between us. We're also different enough from them that diseases that don't necessarily do them a lot of harm could potentially do us a lot of harm. Yeah. Wild animals also interact with each other. So diseases that are present in other mammals could potentially be transmitted to gibbons or macaques or other animals that are kept as pets and then potentially transmitted to us. So not only is there danger to the animals from the pet trade, there's also danger. It's a two-way street. There's danger to us. So if I haven't convinced anyone that for their sake we shouldn't keep them as pets, I hope that people will keep in mind that there's also real potential risk not only to the pet keeper but to the entire community from tolerating this kind of practice. Mm-hmm. And another sort of message that I would want to get out is that in addition to the pet trade is really linked with this problem of habitat loss. When more humans move into an area, it creates more opportunities for the pet trade to flourish for hunting. But the humans moving into the area creates additional challenges. We have to learn to live with wildlife. I'm not saying, you know, we need to just not, you know, give everything up to them. Yeah. But respect, the sort of mutual respect where we create spaces where they can thrive and spaces where we can thrive, and sometimes those spaces are going to be shared and sometimes those spaces are going to be separate, mm-hmm. Is the only way we're going to be able to move forward. So people that live around KL have the incredible luxury of being able to travel just, you know, half an hour to a local park, maybe an hour, and they may even be able to hear gibbons and sea mugs. Maybe even they'll be lucky enough to see them. People might take that for granted and not know how incredibly special that is. I can't think of any other big city in the world where that is possible, actually. Yeah. I mean, I'm so jealous of Malaysians. But that's also fragile. You know, this habitat loss, this incessant development without mind to what it does to wildlife is creating a situation where there's a really big risk that we may lose some of these amazing animals that not only kind of inspire people like Bam and me, but also give joy to hikers and just people living their lives, people in villages that wake up to the beautiful songs of gibbons. You're lucky, Malaysia.
And just to remember that, you know, we only realize it, you know, we shouldn't wait until they're gone before we start trying to do something. That work really needs to begin. Mm-hmm. Well, it should have begun a long time ago, but, you know, it needs to be sustained. Mm-hmm. And how would you like people to help you? Like, I know, Bam, you are running this almost on your own. You know, is there any assistance that, you know, would be helpful to you in any way?
As we know, to run a conservation project, funding is always the critical part.
Yep.
Yeah, I need funding to ensure I can continue to feed, medicate the gibbons and for the daily operation costs. Mm-hmm. And I offer myself to give talks at schools, university, and any event to share with people about these forgotten apes. And if you see any people selling or posting wildlife as pet, you can share with us at our Facebook page, Gibbon Protection Society Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And also you need to report to the authority, to wildlife department, Pahilitan.
And Susan, what about you? Yeah. You know, I mean, like you did mention that you would like, you know, interested students maybe to get in touch.
And there's also, we're also actually, I'm glad you asked, because we're also working on a citizen science project where we are asking people, if you encounter a wild gibbon in peninsular Malaysia, to report that to us. And by encounter, I mean, in particular, if you are able to take a photo or just make a quick recording of a gibbon song, if you don't even see the animal, but you hear them singing. You can, there are a couple of different ways you can send that. We are compiling those results to get a sense of the distribution of gibbons across many different habitats in Malaysia. We can't survey every single forest in the country. So this kind of information can be really, really helpful. So a couple ways of getting us this information. One really fun one is to post your photographs or recordings on a website called iNaturalist.
Yes, I've heard of it. Yeah.
It's, you can also, if you're a birder, put bird photos or any kind of wildlife. Yep. They also have a sound gallery on iNaturalist. And then the information that you've posted there is visible to the public, but we also have a project called Gibbons of Peninsular Malaysia. If you post it to our project, you'll be able to give us privately exact location information. So you can give us, you know, a GPS point for, or a detailed description of where you heard this. It'll be blurred on the sort of main site, so you're not – because it's for all endangered species, they don't post exact locality information, so poachers can't go and get the animals. But they'll make it visible to us if you post it on our project. And then we are compiling information from there. If you don't feel like setting up an account on iNaturalist, you can also email it to us at malaysiangibbons@gmail.com. So that's also our email. And we also have a Facebook page. It's Gibbons of Peninsular Malaysia on Facebook. So you can also send us a private message with information there.
Okay.
So if folks aren't, you know, can't donate or volunteer or become a, you know, professional
researcher,
just tell us what you see. And that would actually be really helpful.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, ladies, for joining me today. And I guess the takeaway message is leave wildlife in the wild.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. I've been speaking to Mariani Ramli. She's the advisor of the Gibbon Protection Society in Malaysia. She's also the project manager of the Gibbon Rehabilitation Project. And Dr. Susan Lappin. She's a visiting Fulbright researcher currently at the School of Biological Sciences in USM. And she's also an assistant professor of biological anthropology at the Appalachian State University in USA. And we were discussing gibbon conservation in Malaysia and, you know, keep gibbons in the wild. They are not pets. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcasts on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.